Welcome to the Science Podcast for September 16th, 2011. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Stuart Wills. This week, a planet that orbits two stars, diamonds that have traveled to the lower mantle and back, life inside the Large Hadron Collider, and a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
For most Earthlings, a planet with two suns conjures up images like Luke Skywalker's home planet in Star Wars. Binary star systems, in which two stars revolve around a mutual center of mass, have been recognized throughout the galaxy, but until recently were never observed to have orbiting circumbinary planets. Using data from NASA's Kepler mission, a team led by Lawrence Doyle of the SETI Institute this week reports the transit of a planet in front of a binary star system, in what they consider to be the most direct evidence yet of a circumbinary planet. Doyle spoke with me about the work.
Basically, what we found is the first transiting circumbinary planet. Most astronomers suspected that planets could form around two stars at once, but this is the first definitive, unambiguous detection of a circumbinary planet.
So in some sense, the first time we've actually, you know, maybe done something analogous to seeing a planet that's orbiting around two stars actually passing in front of those stars.
Yes, exactly. The previous work, including my own, involved timing the two stars' eclipses in order to imply a third body was in orbit around them, especially a third body that was of planetary mass. But this is the first time I think that it is, you know, unambiguous.
Well, this discovery was made with the telescope on the Kepler spacecraft, which, if I understand it correctly, was launched in March 2009 and had the goal of finding potential Earth-like planets, exoplanets. Can you tell me a bit more about that mission and about the instrument and data you were using for this study?
Basically, the Kepler spacecraft is a telescope with a giant wide-angle camera. Like Hubble was designed to look deep into space to determine the age of the universe, I would say Kepler was designed as a wide-angle version, and it was to look at as many stars as possible to see if their planets are orbiting in front of the star to make the light drop a little bit. So Kepler was basically designed to measure the brightnesses of stars about 100 times better than has ever been achieved before, and with the purpose of detecting an Earth moving in front of a disk of a star the size of the sun.
And Kepler, I guess, is monitoring a particular patch of sky, correct?
Yes. What's interesting about Kepler is it's exploring the time realm. In some sense, telescopes that have been launched before look all over the sky, whereas Kepler looks at one place in the sky, but it stares there for a long time. So it's discovered things, stellar oscillations and lots of eclipsing binaries, and it's filled in a lot of science that could only have come by looking at something for a long time.
Okay, so it's been looking at this specific patch, which I think is within the constellations Cygnus and Lyra, according to your paper. What drew your attention to this star system in particular?
Well, for about 3 years before the spacecraft was launched, the Kepler science team had compiled its catalog of stars, the brightest stars up to 15th magnitude or so. But when the spacecraft was launched, I didn't have my targets yet. The eclipsing binary working group had to find the stars that move in front of each other, that eclipse, after launch. So what we first had to do is pick out a couple thousand of the eclipsing binaries that were in the Kepler field. And so our attention was already drawn, once we had that catalog, to the eclipsing binaries. Then what I did is I just looked through all the eclipsing binaries one at a time. And what I was looking at was called a light curve. It's a plot of the brightness of the star with time. And of course, I saw regular eclipses, but then my eye was drawn to some extra eclipses that occurred out of sequence. And I thought, that's either a triple star or it's a planet, a circumbinary planet. Well, many of them turned out to be triple stars but this one turned out to be an actual bona fide planet. And we were able to confirm that using the same light curve, but we looked at it in a different way.
Well, let's talk about the sort of lines of evidence that led you to conclude this was a planet orbiting two stars. Could you take us through that argument and through how the transiting was discovered?
Yes. The eclipses occur regularly, and then these extra dips occurred. And so the first thing we did is we took a spectrum of the two stars in order to determine how big they are. They turned out to be rather small stars. Well, that meant that the extra dips were only 1.7% deep. And since these stars were so small, that something the size of a planet could produce a dip of about 1.7%. So in other words, once we determined the stars were small, we knew that their disks were small and that the drop we had measured could still be planetary size. So the next thing we had to do is then say, okay, if it is a planet, then it shouldn't be able to tug very hard on the two stars. Now, if a third object is a grazing star, in other words, its 1.7% dip is due to the fact that it's not exactly aligned up with the two stars going around each other. So basically, we looked at the pull on the two stars that eclipse each other and asked ourselves, how much would the pull have to be in order for it to be a star? And so we basically looked at the timing of the two stars, and they were not changing their timing very much at all. So we said we knew for a fact then that it wasn't a stellar mass body in orbit around the two stars because they weren't being tugged like they should have been if we'd had such a large mass.
And then I guess, you know, as part of this, you took these data and these light curves and you were fitting them, I believe, if I'm reading your paper correctly, against some numerical models. I'm interested in what you would think are the main sources of uncertainty in this work, or is this completely nailed, you know?
Well, it's pretty nailed. The neat thing is almost all we know about the size of the stars comes from eclipsing binaries because they go around each other and we get to sample their radii. You know, they eclipse each other and we know what their sizes are as a consequence. Virtually all we know about the size of planets outside the solar system is due to transits of the planets in front of their stars. Well, Kepler-16 combines the best of both worlds. We have transits across eclipsing stars. And so we think, I haven't checked the whole literature, but I believe it's the best measured planet in mass and radius outside the solar system to date.
Well, in addition to making these observations of the system as it stands now, one of the things I found interesting in this paper is that you inferred some things about the way the system was formed.
Yes, it's awful hard. The theories that circumbinary planets, if they existed, could be formed by capturing. In other words, the two stars capture the planet. That's very difficult to explain given Kepler-16, because the orbital plane of the two stars is within one-third of a degree aligned with the orbital plane of the planet. Well, that's a circumbinary disk. The other thing is, in consequent research, we found that the rotation axis of the main star is also pointing in the same direction as the orbital axes of the planet and the two stars as well. So in other words, everything's lined up beautifully. It's almost, not only should it be a circumbinary disk, but it has to be a very gentle one. I think theorists are going to be working for some time to try and figure out how everything could be so perfectly aligned.
Well, let's talk a little bit about where this research goes. You've already teased out a lot about this system, but I note at the end of the paper that you actually refer to Kepler-16 as a treasure for exoplanetary and stellar astrophysical investigations. You mentioned just one aspect just now. What else do you think we can get from this system looking ahead?
Well, besides being a lot of fun for theorists to explain how it could have formed, the two stars go around each other in an eccentric orbit, whereas the planet's in a circular orbit. That's kind of interesting because it's supposed to usually be the other way around. The ratio of the periods is 5.5 to 1. So in other words, Kepler-16 is kind of pushing, it hasn't exceeded, but it's kind of pushing the limits for stability. It's pretty close compared to the separation of the two stars. The other component, the smaller star, is the smallest directly measured main sequence star. So in other words, it pushes the limit on the smallest normal type stars ever directly measured. And what's interesting about it is that given its size and mass that we've measured unequivocally, the models of what we understand about stars are underestimating the size. So in other words, here's this definite data point, and all the models underestimate what the size of the star should be there. Plus, the planet itself is half rock and half atmospheric gases. So it's more dense than Saturn, but it's the same mass as Saturn. So, you know, any kind of explanation of the system would also have to explain the composition of the planet. So anyway, it's a busy system. There's lots going on.
Lawrence Doyle, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much. It was fun.
Lawrence Doyle writes about a transiting circumbinary planet in this week's Science. For amateur astronomers, Doyle notes that on June 28, 2012, the transit of this circumbinary planet will be visible to telescopes in the eastern regions of the Northern Hemisphere. The Earth is a dynamic body. New oceanic crust is created at mid-ocean ridges, consumed at subduction zones, and reworked and recycled in the upper mantle. But what happens within the lower mantle? Seismological data suggest that oceanic crust that is sunk into the deep mantle can return to the upper mantle in plumes, but to date there has been no direct petrologic evidence. This week, a team of scientists reports finding diamonds that have made the journey to the lower mantle and back, but whose carbon originated on the surface. It's a finding that could have implications not only for geodynamics, but also for Earth's long-term carbon cycle. Lead author Michael Walter spoke with me about the find.
In a nutshell, what we did was to look at a suite of diamonds from Brazil, and in these diamonds we discovered very minute mineral inclusions. These are of the order of 20 to, say, 30 microns in diameter. And these inclusions have chemical compositions that indicate that they must have formed in the Earth's lower mantle, and more importantly, that they formed from materials that originated in the oceanic crust near the Earth's surface. Then when we looked a little closer at the diamonds themselves, we found out that they have isotopic compositions that also indicate surface-derived material, that is, the carbon came from the surface as well.
Well, okay, before diving into the implications of that, let's quickly orient ourselves for listeners who might not be intimately familiar with the mantle. Could you tell us a bit about the lower mantle, where these diamonds that you looked at came from?
Sure. Now, the mantle makes up most of the Earth and is everything basically in between the crust that we live on and the core, so from about 50 kilometers to about 2,900 kilometers. Now, geologists divide the mantle into upper and lower mantle, and this division is placed at 660 kilometers. It's not an arbitrary depth, but it's based on the observation of a global seismic discontinuity at that depth. So every time a sound wave travels from an earthquake, say in Japan, it goes through the mantle, and some of that energy bounces back off a surface at approximately 660 kilometers. Turns out this is a very important boundary in the Earth because it affects the way mantle convection works, although we're not entirely exactly sure how.
So presumably that seismological disjunction or discontinuity reflects some sort of compositional or mineralogical discontinuity in the mantle itself?
It does. What it is really all about is a change in the mineralogy to more dense phase, because as you go to higher and higher pressures at greater depth, eventually the minerals of the upper mantle just, they can't take it anymore, and they change their structure to more dense phases.
Okay, and these diamonds that you looked at, these so-called super deep diamonds, came from below this 660 kilometer boundary between the upper and lower mantle. How did those diamonds actually get up to the surface, and how can we infer that they actually made that trip? You touched on this, but maybe we can go into it in a bit more detail.
Well, so I mentioned that the minerals undergo changes, and we know that from experiment and from theory. So we can actually take rocks that we think, you know, make up the mantle. We can grind them up and subject them to very high pressures and temperatures, and we can see what kind of minerals that we expect in the lower mantle. So then if we find a mineral inclusion in a diamond that has a particular composition that matches one of these lower mantle phases that we've made in the lab, say, which is exactly what we did here, then we can infer a depth of origin. So we know it came from the lower mantle. Now, if you take the diamond with this lower mantle inclusion and you move it in the mantle to lower pressures, it will again undergo a mineralogic change to whatever mineral or set of minerals is stable at lower pressures. And in that way, we can establish the depth, say, where they last resided in the mantle. And this is exactly what happened to the inclusions that we found. And from their mineralogy and composition, we can estimate that they were slowly transported upward in the solid mantle by, say, at least 500 kilometers. Now, the last stage of the journey then occurs when the diamonds are brought rapidly to the surface, sort of as accidental tourists in a very specific magma type called the kimberlite. And that happens probably from a depth of around 150 or 200 kilometers.
And so these diamonds end up in these deep volcanic rocks called kimberlites.
Right.
And I gather, as you pointed out earlier, that the chemistry of the inclusions in these particular diamonds was rather special.
Yeah, and it's really the key. And I should point out that this isn't the first discovery of inclusions in diamonds from lower mantle. But all previous lower mantle inclusions have compositions that link them to the most common mantle rock type, which is a rock called peridotite. That's what most of the mantle is made of. What was puzzling is that there are many examples of inclusions in diamonds from the upper mantle that must have originated in oceanic crust in a rock called basalt. And this occurs because oceanic crust has returned to the mantle at subduction zones. So it's very explicable that we would find these in diamonds. So the question was, why have we never found an inclusion from the lower mantle that originated in oceanic crust? Is it because all the crust sinks to the core mantle boundary, or maybe the crust doesn't make it into the lower mantle at all? Okay, and these are very important sort of first-order questions related to mantle recycling and geodynamics. Now, when we analyzed the chemistry of one of the inclusions from a diamond from the Juina 5 kimberlite, my colleague Simon Cohn recognized the similarity in composition of one of these inclusions to a mineral known only to occur in basaltic compositions at lower mantle conditions on the basis of experiments. The mineral has a rather unusual name called calcium ferrite. Once we found that one, then we really knew what we were looking for, and the floodgates kind of opened, and we discovered a set of inclusions with compositions linking them to the entire mineral assemblage. That's five different minerals that we expect to occur in basaltic oceanic crust subducted into the lower mantle.
And the chemistry of the diamonds themselves, you noted, you know, diamonds obviously are made of carbon. Tell us about the nature of the carbon in these diamonds that host these inclusions.
Well, once we established that the inclusions originated in basaltic oceanic crust, then we wondered whether the diamonds themselves might tell the same story. Now, we know that organic carbon deposited in oceanic crust by both biogenic and abiogenic processes is depleted in the heavy carbon-13 isotope. And we call that being isotopically light. So I contacted my colleague Steve Shirey at the Carnegie Institution, where they have expertise in analyzing the carbon in diamonds, told him what we had found, and asked him if they might be interested in analyzing the diamonds for us. Steve was very excited by this possibility. And it's not an exaggeration to tell you that within a week, the first data were rolling off their spectrometers, and sure enough, most of the diamonds have extremely light isotopic compositions. So the story of oceanic crust subducted into the lower mantle and returned to the surface really started to come together at this point.
All right, so if I'm understanding this correctly, we have the evidence of basaltic crust in the inclusions, we have evidence of near-surface material that was actually made into these diamonds. It seems that this has implications both for kind of, you know, large-scale plate tectonics and geodynamics, and also maybe a bit surprisingly for something we tend to think of only with respect to the Earth's surface, which is the global carbon cycle. Could you take us through your view of kind of the broad implications and significance of this work in those two areas?
Well, in terms of geodynamics and plate tectonics, I think the implications are, firstly, that oceanic crust clearly makes it into the lower mantle, but some component of that material, at least, can be recycled back to the upper mantle. That is, it doesn't just sink all to the deepest part of the mantle, the core mantle boundary, never to be heard from again. Secondly, it's possible, and this is kind of what we'll do in future work, it's possible to use the inclusions then to track mantle movement. So we can use the mineralogy, as I've explained, to deduce how far the inclusions have moved. And if we can then establish the timing of that movement by dating when the inclusions were trapped and the time that they were brought to the surface in kimberlites, then we have all we need to calculate a mantle upwelling rate directly. which has never been done before. This could, for example, establish whether rapid transport and a mantle plume might be required. For this reason, we like to call the diamonds sort of space and time capsules, because they encapsulate all this information. In terms of the global carbon cycle, our new findings establish that surface carbon clearly survives subduction all the way into the lower mantle. And while in this case, in our study, carbon is returned to the surface, some may clearly go deeper and possibly reside in the lower mantle for long periods of time. And this has implications for the surface carbon budget over Earth's history, which is not very well understood.
Michael Walter, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Michael Walter is lead author of a paper on deep mantle cycling of oceanic crust. It's published online this week at www.scienceexpress.org.
In a News Focus article this week, Science's Adrian Cho takes us inside Europe's Large Hadron Collider to give us an up-close and personal look at the interactions among the thousands of particle physicists that work there. Part of the European Organization for Nuclear Research, known as CERN, the collider is the largest facility of its kind in the world, and with the upcoming closure of Fermilab's Tevatron Collider, is soon to be the only one. Here's Adrian Cho.
My story is about life at the world's biggest atom smasher, the Large Hadron Collider, which is a 27-kilometer-long accelerator at CERN, the European Particle Physics Laboratory, just west of Geneva, Switzerland. And we were curious about what life is like working on the LHC, because the LHC supports two of probably the biggest scientific teams ever assembled. One has 3,000 people working in it, and another has 3,600. And we were curious what life is like as a member of a team of 3,000 physicists.
Well, can you just tell us a little bit about the Large Hadron Collider and how it works and what kind of research is done there?
Sure. So the Large Hadron Collider smashes protons into protons at extremely high energies. Thanks to Einstein's equation, energy equals mass times speed of light squared, if you collide subatomic particles at very high energies, then you can produce new types of subatomic particles that are just going to blip into existence and then almost instantaneously decay. And the name of the game is to see what kind of new particles are out there. This is basically what particle physicists have been doing since the 1930s. And, of course, to produce these ever more massive particles, you need bigger accelerators. So accelerators have gotten bigger and bigger and bigger over the decades, and the LHC is the biggest and most powerful particle accelerator ever built. And so it's a gigantic ring-shaped accelerator that's about 100 meters underground. Protons go through the accelerator in opposite directions and collide in the hearts of four particle detectors. And the two biggest particle detectors are ones named ATLAS and CMS. And these are looking for new types of particles. Many physicists are interested in this particle called the Higgs boson that they've been hunting for decades. And it's the key to physicists' explanation of how all the subatomic particles get their mass, perhaps new dimensions of space that open up in these extremely high energy collisions. There's some really way out ideas like atom-sized black holes, all kinds of things like this. And the other two detectors, LHCb and ALIS, are somewhat smaller, and they're looking at more specialized things. But ATLAS and CMS are the ones that are really in the hunt for big discoveries, and they have the biggest teams, and we were interested in what it's like to work on these experiments.
So you mentioned that the sizes of these teams are over 3,000 people. And then in the paper itself, your two main themes are cooperation and competition. So let's start with cooperation. So when you have so many people, how can the lab be organized and how can the scientists all work and cooperate with one another?
Yeah, so there's a very rich culture in particle physics. In a sense, the way the science is done is kind of forced upon scientists from this regard. Some physicists may be interested in some types of particles and some may be interested in others, but you can't tell which collisions are going to produce which particles, right? It all happens by chance. So the way the field has developed is that the physicists all pull together to build the detector, design the detector, run the detector, maintain the detector, calibrate the detector, get the data out and compress the data, which means put it into an easily analyzed form. And then at the end of the day, after all that cooperative work, the physicists can break down into little teams, and each team will look for what interests it. So it's all much like a big commune where everybody pulls together on the common tasks, but in the end of the day, each physicist can join a group that's interested in whatever he or she may be interested in. And then on top of all that, to underline the collaborative nature of the enterprise, once one particular group within this gigantic collaboration has done an analysis and has got a result that's ready for publication, that result has to be reviewed ultimately by the entire collaboration. Everybody gets a chance to weigh in on it. And if it all measures up and is submitted for publication, then everybody's name goes on the paper. So you'll have, you know, all 3,000 people with their names on the author list, sort of the ultimate act of scientific collaboration.
So it's easy to see how so many people together can also bring on sort of a competitive environment, especially where it seems like there might be some overlap of research. So what are the dangers in that regard?
Well, I'm not so much sure that they're dangers, but I think what's new with the Large Hadron Collider is this element of competition. I mean, if we take a step back, I mean, it's been the case that particle physicists have been working on bigger and bigger teams for decades. I guess way back in the 70s, they started working on teams of, you know, say 100, and this was considered an enormous scientific collaboration at the time. In recent decades, collaboration sizes have gotten, you know, to be 500, 700. There is a particle physics lab in the United States, Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory outside of Chicago, which has a collider, the Tevatron Collider, which runs at about a third the energy of the LHC, and it feeds two big detectors, CDF and D0, and each of them now supports about 500 physicists. But what's changed is, say, 20 years ago, there were more particle physics labs, and there were more of these teams of sort of 500 people, and you would have competition between the teams. Now, with the LHC, you've got these two main teams that are over 3,000 people. The Tevatron Collider in the United States is going to shut down in September, and when that happens, the LHC will largely be the only game in town, and so all of a sudden you have 3,000 people working in a collaboration, and there's only one other collaboration. And as a result, there seems to be as much competition within these collaborations as there is between them. One physicist told me that, you know, these collaborations are basically 5 or 6 times bigger than the collaborations at the Tevatron, and there isn't really 5 or 6 times as many things that you can look at. So they have to compete with each other, and usually a collaboration picks one result as the best analysis, and that's the one that gets published. So there seems to be this awareness that now there's about as much competition within the collaborations as there used to be just between them.
Yeah, and I can imagine you could also have situations where a particular scientist or group of them might go off on their own and try to beat out all of the other groups to their research. Have there been any incidents where you've kind of had poor sportsmanship tactics going on?
This seems to be an issue that physicists are concerned about. In these teams, the different basic topics of physics are divided into these working groups. And so there is this worry that somebody may try to do the analysis on their own without working with the working group and then sort of come in at the last minute with a complete analysis and say, you know, ta-da, I've discovered the Higgs boson, give me all the credit. And there is one incident that may have been an example of this. It involves essentially rumors from April when there were reports that made it to the blogosphere and ultimately into the press that one group from the University of Wisconsin that is working in the ATLAS collaboration had discovered the Higgs boson decaying into two photons. And it turned out that what had happened is that this team had claimed that they'd seen the signal and they'd written this up in an internal memo, and somehow the memo got leaked. And a lot of physicists presumed that this was an attempt by this team to claim discovery and basically get the drop on the rest of the collaboration. On the other hand, the physicists Salan Wu of the University of Wisconsin, who heads this group, swears that they did not try to pull a fast one on the rest of the collaboration. She tells me that the subgroup wasn't due to meet for a week or so they wrote this internal memo, and she says that, you know, they were very much trying to play within the rules of how you present something to the subgroup. So, you know, whether or not this was an attempt to scoop the rest of the collaboration, there were a lot of people who viewed it that way, apparently.
Well, in light of all this opportunity for competition within these groups, how do you think that the Large Hadron Collider, the whole team there, will fare once the Tevatron lab is closed?
Well, I'm not sure that the closing of the Tevatron will make that big a difference because, to be honest, people have known for years now that the action would be shifting to CERN from Fermilab. So most of the people working on the Tevatron experiments already have spots either in CMS or ATLAS. So that bridge has already been made. On the other hand, it will be an interesting world when it's just these two big collaborations really going toe-to-toe. In some sense, the whole world of particle physics will be at CERN, and it seems with 3,000 people, you have this possibility of kind of rivalry between groups within the 3,000-member collaboration that maybe isn't quite as present when you have only 500 people.
Well, Adrian Cho, thank you so much for speaking with me.
My pleasure.
Adrian Cho writes about the balance between collaboration and competition at the Large Hadron Collider in a News Focus this week.
Finally today, David Grimm, Science's online news editor, is here to fill us in on some recent stories on our daily news site. Well, Dave, today it appears to be testosterone, folic acid, and glowing kittens. Where to possibly begin?
Well, I guess we'll begin with testosterone. That's something at least a lot of the men in the audience, I'm sure, will be interested in. And this story is about whether fatherhood decreases testosterone. As our original headline read, does fatherhood make men wimpy? It's a bit of an overstatement, but the general question is, does being a father have an effect on a man's hormone levels? And the reason this question came to the fore is because previous studies had shown that men that are fathers tended to have lower testosterone than men that aren't fathers. But in this new study, researchers wanted to see, well, what's the cause and effect here? Do men with lower testosterone, are they more likely to become fathers? Or is it the other way around? Do men tend to have higher testosterone, but then they become fathers and something about fatherhood lowers their testosterone?
And so how would you go about separating cause and effect in something like that?
Well, luckily, in this new study, researchers had access to a very large data set from a trial that's been going on in the Philippines, which has been looking at hundreds of men and women over there. And they followed 600 men from the trial. They had first tested these men in 2005. They had taken some saliva samples from them in which they can actually test testosterone levels. And then they sampled the men again about 4 years later. And it turns out that in the intervening time, some of these men had gotten married and had children. And what the researchers noticed is that the men who had become fathers had about a 26 to 34% decrease in testosterone levels. So this seemed to suggest to the researchers that having children in itself is enough to bring testosterone levels down.
And I guess it wasn't just having children. There was something about the level of commitment, too.
Well, the study also showed that testosterone levels were lowest in men who reported spending the greatest amount of time caring for their children, which
is almost like a dose response.
Exactly. Effect. And that's really led the researchers to conclude that this drop in testosterone may actually be very important biologically and even evolutionarily. The idea is that high testosterone levels are often associated with aggression and competition. And whereas high testosterone level may be good when you're single, it may be make you more competitive and maybe perhaps make you more attractive to females. Once you start having kids, actually high testosterone levels can be a detriment. Other studies have shown that men with high testosterone tend to have more marital problems, that they get divorced more often, also that they're less likely to pay attention to the screams of a baby, which would be very bad in a relationship if the father was constantly ignoring his screaming infant. So what these researchers are suggesting here is that these low testosterone levels may make dads calmer, may make them more caring, may make them more likely to stick around. Of course, this is all speculation at this point, but at the very least, they can conclude that fatherhood does seem to have this dramatic effect on men's hormone levels.
And next, some potential folly in folic acid supplements.
Well, right, Stuart. This next study is about, well, it's about to be very controversial, potentially. It basically suggests that folic acid, which a lot of women take to prevent birth defects, may have some negative consequences. But before I get too far into this, I want to say that the experts have a lot of questions about this study. So got to take these findings with a bit of a grain of salt, although they are very provocative. Basically, you may or may not know, Stuart, that a lot of women in the U.S. take folic acid. It's actually, not only do they take it, but a lot of our food is actually supplemented, especially in the U.S., but also in other countries, is actually supplemented with folic acid.
Well, what exactly is folic acid?
Well, Stuart, folic acid is a vitamin, and we consume it naturally when we eat leafy vegetables. That has a lot of folic acid, or folate, as it's sometimes called. But not everybody gets enough. And a few years ago, doctors noticed that women who are deficient in folic acid had a greater chance of having children with birth defects, especially birth defects of the spine, skull, and brain. But that those that doubled their recommended dose of folic acid were about 40 to 50% less likely to have children with these defects. And ever since then, the U.S. has fortified most of its grains with folate, and since 1998, and actually a lot of other countries do this as well. So it's really become a standard part of our diet because doctors said, you know, it's so important for the health of newborn children.
And so there's a new study with a mouse model that is maybe looking at this differently?
Exactly. Well, the mouse model the researchers used, these mice were genetically predisposed to giving birth to embryos with neural tube defects. And these are the type of defects that are also seen in human babies of mothers that have this folate deficiency. And what the researchers did was they supplemented the rodent's diet with folate, and they gave them similar concentrations to people that are taking either moderate or very high levels of folate. And what the researchers saw, which was really surprising, is that in one of these mouse lines, the mice that were taking folate, their offspring actually had a 20 to 60% increase in neural tube defects. And another strain of mice that were taking high levels of folate actually had a lot of miscarriages. They lost a lot of their embryos before these embryos were born.
Wow. We'll talk about the law of unintended consequences.
Right. And so again, big heaps of caution here, because what experts are saying is this is intriguing, definitely something that should be looked more at. But there are a lot of things that happen in mice that don't happen in people, and especially when it comes to birth defects. For example, thalidomide, which has developed such a bad reputation for causing birth defects in humans, is actually perfectly safe in mice, doesn't cause birth defects at all. So we could be having an opposite situation here, whereas folate potentially causing birth defects in mice, whereas it doesn't in humans. There's also a whole host of other mutations that cause birth defects in mice that don't produce the same problems in humans. And you'll have to remember, again, that the mice used in this study were genetically modified to really have these genetic defects, to have offspring that have these defects in the first place. So you're really dealing with a lot of variables here, and it's hard to make a firm conclusion about what it all means. What the researchers are saying is, you know, it's intriguing, should be studied further, and don't go out right now and throw all your folate down the toilet.
Maybe eat those leafy vegetables.
Exactly.
And finally, the glowing kittens, and something, I guess, with relevance to the AIDS epidemic.
Well, right, Stuart. There's actually, believe it or not, there's two AIDS epidemics in this world. One that affects humans, and that's caused by HIV. But there's also something very akin to the AIDS epidemic in cats, and it's caused by a virus known as FIV, or feline immunodeficiency virus. And we can't catch FIV from cats, and they can't catch HIV from us, but the two viruses are actually very similar. They're both known as lentiviruses. And researchers think they understand why cats can catch FIV and humans don't. They think it boils down to a protein known as TRIM-CYP. And this protein is present in humans, but not present in cats. And it seems to be involved in recognizing the outer shell of these lentiviruses. So researchers have said, I wonder if the fact that cats lack this TRIM-CYP protein is the reason they're susceptible to FIV. But obviously not a very easy thing to test. You can't just put a bunch of TRIM-CYP in cats and see if they're resistant to FIV.
And that, I guess, is where the glowing kittens come in.
That's exactly where the glowing kittens come in. It turns out you can. And there was a way to do this before, actually. And researchers have actually created what they've called transgenic cats before, which is basically creating a genetically modified cat that has new genes that you put into it. But it was a very laborious process. It was called a somatic cell nuclear transfer. And if you remember all the way back to Dolly the sheep being cloned, this is basically the same process. You replace the nucleus of an egg cell with a nucleus that contains some genes that you want. You put it back in the egg. You put the egg in the mother, and you hope that it leads to offspring. Well, it's a very inefficient process. It only has about a 3% success rate. And you can imagine if you're in a laboratory and you really want to study something as important as FIV or HIV, you want a much higher success rate. So in this new study, the researchers actually took advantage of the fact that these lentiviruses can infect cats. And so they took a lentivirus and they genetically modified it so that it contained this TRIM-CYP gene, so they could get this TRIM-CYP gene into cats. And they also added a gene for a fluorescent protein. And that way they would know which cats had actually become infected with the virus. And then what they did was they took a bunch of egg cells from female cats, they mixed it up with the virus so the virus would infect the egg cells. They allowed sperm to fertilize the egg, and then they put these eggs in female cats.
And what happens when you do that?
And what happens when you do that is, first of all, you have a much higher success rate than you had with somatic cell nuclear transfer. The researchers had a success rate of about 23% versus 3%. But you also end up with a lot of glowing kittens, and you actually see a picture of a couple glowing kittens on the website. Now, that may sound cute, but it is evidence that these cats actually have this new gene, this gene for TRIMSIP, in their bodies.
Okay, so they've got the protein in their bodies. Now, how do you make the connection with FIV from that?
So what the researchers did was they took blood cells from the genetically modified kittens and they tried to infect the cells with FIV. And lo and behold, FIV did not replicate well in these cells. Now, the next step, which they haven't done yet, is actually to try to infect these kittens with FIV to see if actually their whole bodies are resistant and not just their blood cells. But if it's successful, it's a very important advance for science because it suggests a new way to combat FIV and potentially even HIV in humans.
Okay, Dave, well, what other stories are you looking at for the news site?
Well, Stuart, for Science Now, we've got a story about why some people are much more susceptible to the flu than others, and indeed why some people are killed by the flu while others aren't. Also a story about how snails use birds as taxis. And for Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about the future of NASA, what is happening to space exploration over the next decade or so. Also plagiarism in the Congo. And finally, on Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science. This week's Science Live is about neuroscience in the courtroom. What role is neuroscience playing in convicting criminals? So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the September 16th, 2011 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Stuart Wills. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.